Wednesday, sunny, highs 46 to 50 degrees. It's 6 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens.
Family unfriendly. The government shutdown is entering its second month, and the lack of federal funding is cutting off programs that offer children access to food and education. An educator tells us her Head Start program is still running, but it won't be able to stay that way much longer.
And finding the right spacehead space. A new Canadian study will follow astronauts to the International Space Station and beyond to better understand how they can stay grounded so far from any actual ground.
Those stories and more coming up for you on the Monday edition of As It Happens.
Coming up an hour ahead of the news from Canada, it is As It Happens. At 7 o'clock tonight, DJ the DJ is your host for On the River. And if you missed Headwaters this morning, Kari Hedlund is our host. That begins tonight at 10 o'clock. Up next from Minnesota News Connection, how Minnesota's soon-to-be frozen farm fields hold a future for clean jet fuel. We receive support this evening from Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative committed to community and giving back through scholarships, youth programs, Operation Roundup, and more. Lake Country Power, made by the community, for the community. And thanks to Rapids Brewing Company, they're a place for gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week. Farm fresh food and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. Election Day is tomorrow, November 4th. 13 school districts in rural northern Minnesota are asking residents to support referendums in the special elections this year. The KEXC news team has gathered information on the referendums and details on how to vote. Find it at KEXC.org. Headwaters is your source for great music. It's weekdays from 9 to 11. Tomorrow, tune in for Brainerd folk musician Kelly Smith, joining the program to talk about the upcoming Grassroots Concert Series in Nisswa. Smith is the new artistic director for the series that began back in 1988. Here's Larissa Donovan.
Pretty soon, Minnesota's farm fields will be in a deep freeze, but some seeds will still be doing their work. Farmers trying out a winter-hardy crop are at the forefront of a production process to create cleaner fuel for commercial jets. This fall, the University of Minnesota's Forever Green Initiative is in the early stages of a study to determine the next steps for sustainable aviation fuel. A key ingredient is winter camelina, a cover crop that not only protects the soil from erosion, but also has the potential for commercial use. Forever Green's co-director Mitch Hunter says right now they're green rows of little plants that will fully blossom in the spring.
And then after the plant flowers, those flowers will turn into fruit packed with seeds. And inside each one of those seeds, you have 35% oil.
Minnesota researchers and their partners are leading a charge to convert that seed oil into low-carbon jet fuel that airlines can use to reduce their emissions. Last fall, a test flight using SAF flew out of the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport. Hunter says the latest research aims to lay out a blueprint detailing what's needed to scale up production. Challenges include perfecting crop varieties and finding enough processing capacity. In northern Minnesota, fourth-generation farmer Eric Kakowski just planted his share of winter camelina across roughly 640 acres. It's his third season of trying this crop out. Like researchers, there's a learning curve for him, including the best time in the fall for putting the seeds in the ground. But he says it's an easy crop to manage.
I don't have to babysit it. I can take care of my other crops and make sure they're producing like they're supposed to.
Groups like Friends of the Mississippi River back the movement because of the chance to improve water quality with healthier farmland. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for the story. Larissa Donovan, KAXE News.
Coming up, we'll have the news from Canada. It's As It Happens. But right now, new music from Brandi Carlile.
You're only gonna hurt your back looking down like that. Cut yourself a little more slack, baby. You're gonna have a heart attack, and they won't thank you. They don't make awards for that. We know by now the time does not take sides.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight,
a foregoing concern. Before tomorrow's federal budget, Prime Minister Mark Carney says Canadians are going to have to make some sacrifices, which is not what anyone who is already making sacrifices wants to hear.
Taking care. It's already created a crisis for families that rely on federal food assistance, and now the U.S. government shutdown is threatening the child care program many of those same families depend on.
The Toasts of the Towns will take you to Tantramar, New Brunswick, in the first of a week-long series on smaller communities across Canada and the controversies, characters, and cultures that defy their size.
And letter perfect. A New York man doesn't just talk a good game, he talks the best game. After 20 years of complex computing, he's revealed the Boggle board that contained the most possible words. As it happens, the Monday edition, radio that minds the Boggle. For weeks, Prime Minister Mark Carney has been preparing Canadians for sacrifices, his word. Tough choices, he says, are necessary to build what he calls a bigger, better Canada. And tomorrow, we will find out exactly how painful those sacrifices will be when this government tables its first budget. In keeping with tradition, Finance Minister François-Philippe Champagne spoke to reporters while purchasing the traditional new budget shoes earlier today and offered a few hints about what Canadians can expect.
This is going to be an investment budget, the kind of budget that you will remember, because there will be no surprises. Canadians have asked us to build big, bold things. They expect us to do things differently. So we're going to make generational investments that will build our country. We're moving from reliance to resilience, from uncertainty to prosperity. We're going to do the kind of things that will make this country stronger. And everyone will see themselves in that budget.
What those generational investments will be and who will feel them most is what everyone is waiting to find out. David Dodge is a former governor of the Bank of Canada and served as Canada's Deputy Minister of Finance from 1992 to 1997. He's in Ottawa.
David Dodge, you know, as well as I do, that many Canadians are already making a lot of sacrifices, trying to make ends meet. So what should they be prepared for tomorrow?
I would say more sacrifice, in the sense that the government is not going to be able to provide any relief very early, certainly not very much relief on the household spending side, and at the same time is not going to be able to increase transfers to offset some of the difficult things that are coming from the U.S. tariffs.
Who or what do you think is going to be sacrificed? What should Canadians be prepared to see cut, potentially?
Well, there are two things. First of all, the sacrifice is coming from changes in the economy itself. And those changes require higher levels of saving on the part of Canadians, require somewhat lower levels of consumption on the part of Canadians in order to finance and pay for the investment that is necessary to raise the productivity of people and hence raise the GDP over time.
If we go back in time to when you were Deputy Minister of Finance, as our listeners heard, from 1992 to 1997, how would you compare those years, 95, for example, in particular, with what Canada and Canadians are facing right now?
We had a single problem back in 95, and that was we had very high interest rates and we had extraordinarily high deficits and hence very high charges for debt service. And that's what we were addressing in 95. Today, the problem is much more difficult for the government than we had because we have an economy that is suffering from major changes that are going on in the world, including U.S. tariffs, and from the fact that for the past 15 years, we've not made the investments we should have made to raise productivity.
What kinds of investments do you want to see? What would make you the happiest when you look through that budget document tomorrow?
Well, let me first say that what's really important over time is that the private sector make investments to raise the amount of capital that each worker has so that indeed his or her productivity can be raised. So that's the what's really important. But what we're going to see in the budget is a complementary investment in public infrastructure. But I don't think we're going to see anything in the budget that is actually going to induce private investment.
Take us back to the conversations you were having at the time, if we could be a fly on the wall at that time, because you have to put this document together, you have to make the right decisions for the country and for Canadians, then you have to sell it to them. So what were you saying to each other at the time to make sure this was the right course of action and to get Canadians on board?
Well, first, Canadians were prepared and understood. At that point, we had to bring the deficit down. Today, I'm not sure that Canadians really understand that our big problem is that we have to make investment to raise productivity, raise incomes in the future. So it's a different set of problems that the government faces today than we faced back then.
But it's difficult. It can be difficult, as you can imagine, to hear them say, we need you to make sacrifices, but we're going to invest in these things. We might cut back the public service, the services that Canadians rely on. How should they weigh all of those things?
Well, I think in the end, we have to expect that we're going to reduce the services that we as individual households receive from government. I mean, that's one side of it. The other side of it is that unless we, in fact, raise our productivity, in fact, the amount of private goods and services that we're going to be able to consume in the short run is going to go down. So it's just a very difficult circumstance that Canadians are facing. And what the budget, I think, is trying to do, if I listen to Mr. Champagne, is to raise investment now so that we can begin to have growth in GDP in the future. But that will not mean growth this year or next year. In fact, this year and next year are going to be very tough.
It sounds like you have a little bit of sympathy for Minister Champagne and the Carney government.
Yes, I think it's a very difficult situation that we're in, that the government's trying to navigate through. And added to that is the uncertainty as to what the Americans are going to do in respect of tariffs. And those tariffs simply reduce the ability of Canada to sell abroad and reduce our national income. So it's a very difficult circumstance that we as Canadians, not just the government of Canada, but we as Canadians find ourselves in at the moment.
David Dodge, I appreciate this. Thank you.
You're welcome.
David Dodge is a former governor of the Bank of Canada and served as Canada's Deputy Minister of Finance in the 1990s. We reached him in Ottawa. Times are already tough for American families that rely on federal food assistance that's blocked by the ongoing government shutdown right now. But things might get even tougher. A lot of people in the U.S. who depend on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, also access childcare via the Head Start program, a federal preschool initiative that helps low-income families. That program is now in jeopardy. The federal money that was supposed to roll in on November 1st hasn't, and dozens of centers have signaled that they'll have to close down. Head Start students at the Emmanuel Family and Child Development Center in Kansas City, Missouri, are still in school for now. Deborah Mann is the executive director of the Emmanuel Center. We reached her in Kansas City.
Deborah, I know you were just at the grocery store. What were you buying?
Actually, we were at the grocery store. A local construction company owner, Latasha McCall, decided to jump in and help our families at the center by buying them groceries to try to get through this SNAP benefit shutdown. So we were there just giving out cards and watching families come in and fill their baskets up with groceries.
What kinds of things are our parents and families telling you when they come to the center since the shutdown and knowing that these deadlines were coming and these benefits were going to stop?
They are saying they have to make a decision between paying their bills, paying their rent, and buying food. And they're worried because they know they have to pay their rent and they need a place over their head, but they also know they need to feed their children. So it's a catch-22. Which one is going to be more important right now?
And then that's within their own households. Head Start offered, I would imagine, a bit of respite from that worry because, there's medical screening, there's free learning, this is all federally funded, and then
yes.
Meals as well. So what are they saying when you tell them the realities about the shutdown and its impact on Head Start?
This is tremendous because we have 20 classrooms. Of those 20 classrooms, 12 are Head Start, early Head Start. So that's over half of the kids that attend our program. And so you get a double whammy. You get families that are faced with possibly no child care and then possibly no food in the very place they come to make sure their kids get a good meal. And now you're saying they may not can come. And so it's adding so much stress and tension and worry to our families who already struggle and have other worries.
And how many students are we talking about at your school?
Oh, roughly 400.
And that's the whole school or the ones who are in Head Start?
That is the whole school. Mm-hmm. Of that, minus probably about 60.
Mm-hmm. What do you tell the children?
I mean, how do you look in a child's face and say, or a parent looks in their child's face and say, I'm sorry, we don't have any food? You can't. The children have no control of this. We have to do something as a community, as an organization, as a nation to figure this out and resolve it quickly. We're in the urban core, and a lot of the families we serve, they're barely making it anyway. And some of them are in school trying to get a better education, and now they're worried about how they're going to feed their family.
And how are teachers dealing with all of this in their classrooms and this uncertainty?
And so those, some of our teachers fall in the same categories. Mm-hmm. They have SNAP benefits because we know early childhood is not the best as we would want it to be as far as pay. And so they're depending on the SNAP benefits to support their families and to bridge the gaps of the food costs that they have. Our teachers are worried, are we going to be open? You know, federal funding is reimbursable, so it's not like we get it in advance.
You have a lot of people that you need to try to calm and talk to. What do you say to the teachers?
You know, this has been the first time I would say that I've ever been in a space of uncertainty. I mean, I know it was uncertain when COVID was hit, but we had so many people coming together, pulling and supporting us and helping us stay open. So we survived COVID. But when you look at this, this is such a bigger problem. Even the foundations in our city have said, we don't have the capacity to fund these programs or support them until the federal government comes to a census of what they're going to do. I tell my staff, I just need you to have some hope, have some faith mm-hmm. that something's going to give. We're going to make it. I'm going to stay open and keep the doors open as long as I can. But it's very hard.
And what do you have a sense of how long you could actually keep those doors open? I know from reading some of the reporting that different head starts are on different fiscal calendars. The funding will come or run out at different times. What is the calendar looking like for you?
It's day by day. We don't have a big, huge reserve. We are probably good for another month.
You talked about the construction company that's helping buy the groceries that you were able to get today. We spoke to a woman last week on the program who was running. She basically set up a food bank out of her own home, you know, to try to help people around her. So people are trying to come together. But from what you're saying, that kind of individual help, although welcome, will not be able to keep you going past that month.
No. I'm depending on October's money to come in now for November. So if we don't have November's, I don't have anything else.
You may have heard the Trump administration said today in response to some court rulings that were requiring them to keep SNAP going. They said that they would partially fund SNAP, but that could take months for that money to kick in and there's calculations involved. Does that movement give you any more hope that perhaps for the families who need it, those SNAP benefits, but also that some sort of agreement, they could come to an agreement about Head Start as well?
It does give me hope. It's still the caveat, how long? We're hoping that if they see enough media and our legislators can understand the impact this is really having, and as we advocate, that something will come sooner. We need a breakthrough now. We really do. Later could be too late.
Deborah, I appreciate this. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for interview, and I appreciate all that you guys are doing to get it out there so people can understand the importance of what's happening locally and what is happening around the world.
Deborah Mann is the executive director of the Emmanuel Family and Child Development Center in Kansas City, Missouri. That's where we reached her. Over the weekend, the International Space Station reached a major milestone, 25 years of continuous human habitation. That means a quarter century of international cooperation, scientific discovery, and gazing awestruck at the wonders of the cosmos. It also means 25 years of something we experience on Earth, getting stressed out. After all, these are people living and working in one of the most extreme environments imaginable. Confined quarters, long isolation, constant high stakes. And a Canadian researcher wants to understand how they cope. Yelena Berchich of the University of Fraser Valley is leading a study looking at the astronauts' mental health before, during, and after their missions, and what their experiences could teach us here on Earth. We reached her in Vancouver.
Yelena, obviously a lot of the coping mechanisms we have here on Earth to deal with stress are not available, not options on the space station. You know, people might take a quick walk, breath of fresh air, that sort of thing. That's not possible there. So what is your understanding of how astronauts are dealing with stress right now?
So I want to point out that there are highly trained, extremely capable humans. And so they do have this briefcase of coping mechanisms at their disposal. And so from our previous research, not directly on the station, but through archival documents and through other analog environments on Earth, we find that they most often tend to problem solve. When there's a problem and a situation they need to cope with, they do try to come up with different solutions to it. And they do often reach out to those around them for emotional support, but also for informational support. You know, how do I do this kind of a thing?
And it was July last year, I spoke with Commander Kelly Haston. She was on a NASA mission where a group of volunteers spent a year in isolation simulating life on Mars. And I want to play for you and our listeners a little bit of what she said about going through loss while being away from a support system.
Everyone experiences challenges in these settings when you're away from your family and you can't help them in the same way. You can't communicate with them in the same way that you're used to. And my family certainly did experience some deep sorrows and a loss. I did feel great sadness during this mission over that loss. And also, you know, it was very difficult to be away from my family during that time. And, you know, it is a cost of people doing space exploration or even analogs that are going to help space exploration one day.
And she also, I remember, talked a lot about the day-to-day life on the space station. So, you know, they're dealing with so much and then the science and the research on top of that and the difficult surroundings. What is day-to-day life, from as you understand it, on the space station?
It's the space station is a lot of science. They do over, you know, hundreds of experiments. They're kind of participants in everybody's science, but also it's a lot of upkeeping your house. The ISS has been up there for 25 continuous years. And so, you know, something gets broken, they have to fix it. There's nobody else to fix it. And they do a lot of communication with Earth, with schools, with, you know, media. And they do a lot of photography. I think that's one of the things they really, really enjoy is photography of important places on Earth.
Yeah. That what she was talking about, the commander there, about grief and experiencing those kinds of losses. What are you hoping to learn, if you haven't already, about what it is like in those situations on the International Space Station?
Yeah, she's absolutely right. Grief is a totally individual thing. And what we're trying to learn is how to capitalize on some of the other things that is available to them. And we're trying to understand what is currently available, but what won't be available when we go to the moon and Mars. And we are preparing for those missions to Mars where, you know, right now we can talk to Earth and we can get support from those near and close to us in a different fashion than we would if we were on Earth. But on the way to Mars, that communication delay is huge. And mm-hmm. So we're hoping to understand what positives can we capitalize on in our study, actually. Is there something about how meaningful their work is, their experiences? Is there something about the awe, the gratitude, the compassion of this experience that we can capitalize on and give them another avenue of coping with some situations, for example, what you described there?
You're not going to be physically out there with the astronauts. So how are you? Maybe you wish you were. Yeah. How are you going to?
I think I'm too extroverted.
Yes. How are you going to gather data for your study?
So we're gathering data on the ground before they go, a bunch of questionnaires, an interview, and physiological data. And when they're up there, we'll collect data about 20 times, standard psychological measures, brief standard psychological measures, and physiological data. And so we're trying to see, you know, how does one's body adapt to stress psychologically and physiologically? And then when they come back down to Earth, we'll repeat some of those tests and another qualitative interview. And here, we're extremely interested in the reintegration into Earth. Does any growth happen? And growth and resilience is really important because then we can use those as potential countermeasures, as potential tools to help explain long-term well-being in people that do go into these environments.
Obviously, you'll learn a lot from these astronauts that will benefit them and other astronauts as well. But you've also said that you can see this kind of information helping other people in high-stress jobs. Who are you talking about there? Who are you hoping, who else are you hoping this will help?
So there are lots of humans on Earth in these working in remote, confined conditions. So, for example, search and rescue teams, they are out there a lot, and they're dealing with unpredictable situations. Wildfire firefighters, remote healthcare workers up in the north. And so we're hoping to learn how we can capitalize on some of these positives in our research to come up with some scalable solutions to improve this emotional well-being in these professions, to give them tools to overcome some of the stressful experiences, and hopefully to help them find more meaning in the really important work that they do as well.
For the work you do, is the ISS kind of a dream lab?
Absolutely. This is like, oh my gosh, this is like a candy shop for me.
Well, Yelena, I'm very glad we could speak. And maybe we'll speak again once you have more data and perhaps results. Thank you for this.
Hopefully. Thank you so much.
Yelena Berchich is an associate professor at the University of the Fraser Valley School of Business. We reached her in Vancouver. The sound of Boggle shaking the letter cubes around in the thing before starting the timer. Every time you play, you stare at that jumble of 16 letters and you think about how to get the highest score. No times that you play do you think about what Boggle board would hypothetically yield the highest possible score. But for a while, that was all Dan Vanderkam could think about. He was never that interested in playing the game. What he was interested in was a complex computing problem. What arrangement of the 16 letter cubes would produce the most words and the most points? Now, that is the kind of thought that some people would have once and then realize they shouldn't have taken that second gummy. But Mr. Vanderkam actually needed to know the answer. He needed to. And since 2004, in his spare time, of course, he has worked on a project that would provide the answer. This year, he succeeded. And now, the perfect Boggle board. Are you ready? Here goes. PERSLATGSINETERS. These letters will yield 1,045 words for a total score of 3,625 points. Dan Vanderkam also calculates that the odds you'll ever get this board are approximately 1 in 10 to the 19th power, which he points out is in the ballpark of the number of stars in the universe. Well, he made this discovery in April. Now he has announced that after 20 years, he's largely done with the Boggle problem. So, round of applause for Mr. Vanderkam. It's an exciting achievement, but like Boggle cubes, it has left us shaken. Here's Chromeo with Words With You.
She must be heaven sent. Oh yeah. But as of late, communication started to deteriorate. And not great. Now I gotta have a word with you. I gotta have a word with you. I heard the rumors percolating round the side. Didn't listen too much.
Romeo with Words With You.
We are going to take a short break now. When we return, the first stop in our hometown series.
Every day this week, we'll take you to smaller towns and cities where big things are happening. And we'll start today with the recently incorporated town of Tantramar, New Brunswick, which you might know as Sackville. Stay tuned. I'm Chris Howden.
And I'm Neil Kirksall.
We've been listening to As It Happens here on People Powered KAXC. At 7 o'clock, we are on the river with your host, DJ the DJ. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Increasing clouds tonight, lows 30 to 33, and a slight chance for rain early tomorrow, highs 50 to 54. The music team at KEXC has a great week lined up for you on Headwaters. Tomorrow, Brainerd folk musician Kelly Smith joining the program to talk about the upcoming grassroots concert series in Nisswa. Then on Wednesday, a live session and interview with Americana band Megan and the Birdwatcher, who recently released their second album called Americana Dream. And then on Thursday, tune in for the latest Spin That Ish, the music team sharing their favorite music.
Hello again and welcome back. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens, the Monday edition, part two. Coming up.
Hometown heroes. This half hour, we have the first in our series taking you to smaller corners of Canada where huge things are happening.
Salt of the earth. In the first of these segments, we'll take you to the recently incorporated town of Tantramar, New Brunswick, home to about 14,000 people, a celebrated salt marsh, and a disproportionately robust cultural scene.
Power struggle. We'll learn about a proposed gas plant there that is raising questions about Indigenous ownership, American involvement, and the transition to renewables in New Brunswick and beyond.
News they could have used. A retired journalist explains why he unretired to fill a void in the local media landscape and tells us how his fellow citizen journalists are stepping up.
And state of the arts. We'll find out why the small town of Sackville, New Brunswick is such a bustling hub that one of Canada's best-known boutique publishers is moving there.
That's all coming up on the Tantramar edition of As It Happens. Stay tuned. At first glance, the stretch of land in Center Village, New Brunswick, doesn't really look like much. It's just evergreens and underbrush alongside a two-lane highway about 20 minutes north of the Tantramar Marshes. But that seemingly nondescript piece of the province has recently become the focal point of a debate in the legislature and now, belatedly, on our airwaves. I say belatedly because the story of the proposed construction of a 500-megawatt gas plant by an American-owned company on unceded Mi'kmaq territory is exactly the kind of story the news should cover. And to be clear, our colleagues in New Brunswick have been covering it. But they've been doing it in a media landscape that kind of mirrors the physical landscape I just described.
Media ownership in Atlantic Canada shrank a bit more last week. Thursday, owners of the Chronicle Herald announced they bought up all transcontinental newspapers in the region.
The acquisition creates a new media company called Saltwire, which now becomes Atlantic Canada's largest independently owned media company.
The Sackville Tribune Post stopped publishing its newspaper after the pandemic hit last March and has not returned. Saltwire won't confirm with the
coverage from 2017 and after that 2021 on the acquisition and eventual demise of the Sackville Tribune Post. The paper was one of many in Atlantic Canada purchased by Transcontinental and then Saltwire and then shut down. In a few minutes, we'll hear what that closure has meant to the community. But first, more on the gas plant I just mentioned, a story that would be front page news if the Tribune Post were still in print today. Megan Mitten is the Green Party MLA for Tantramar and one of the most vocal opponents of the project. We reached her in Sackville, New Brunswick.
Megan Mitten, how did you find out about all of this, that NB Power was planning to build a new gas plant in Tantramar?
I found out when NB Power sent out a press release the morning that they were announcing it publicly. And at first, because the word renewable is is in the title. I thought they were going to build a renewable energy project, and I got excited for a moment. And as I kept reading, I realized they were going to build a fracked gas and diesel plant. And it was really upsetting for a lot of people in the community. We were really blindsided, frankly. And a lot of the, like, you know, environmental impact assessment processes and stuff, we found out in July, and a lot of these happened in July and August. And so we really felt they were trying to rush this through, try to get it past us. But they certainly are not going to get it past this community without a big fight.
As you have likely seen and heard, NB Power says this gas plant is necessary to support the transition to renewables because the province's ability to store power generated from wind and solar is limited, and that those sources can be unreliable during peak times. NB Power is also warning the province might run out of baseload power within a matter of a few years. So what is your response to that argument?
Well, they're presenting it as the only option, but it certainly isn't the only option. For one thing, it's a very expensive option. They've admitted that this will cost at least $1 billion, and they've hired an American company, ProEnergy, to come in and do this. So with all that money, we should be increasing energy efficiency, installing more heat pumps, and investing in renewable energy and storage. And so really, I'm not buying what they're selling.
And to those concerns that they seem to be underlining there, that, you know, in just a couple of years, they're going to run short of baseload power. For people listening in the region there, they might be concerned about that. So what would you say to them as their bills go up too, obviously?
Yeah, and the bills are going up, for one thing, because of years and years of mismanagement. And the thing is, their story also keeps changing. Is this a peaker plant or is this for baseload power? If this was for baseload power, this wouldn't make the most sense either. This is a 25-year contract that they're signing with an American corporation. And some of the people that will profit from that, just a note, are Trump donors. So we should be looking at renewables and things that save us money in the long term and ramping up energy efficiency. So that we don't have to use as much power.
There's another sticking point, as you well know, but to let our listeners in on that, early on in all of this, ProEnergy falsely claimed that a group of seven Mi'kmaq nations in New Brunswick held a minority stake in this project. Again, that was not the case. Mm-hmm. Another of the nations that would be most affected by this development, the Elsipogtog Nation, has expressed serious concerns about the proposal. So where does that leave things?
Well, I think it's pretty unforgivable to misrepresent having Indigenous equity partnership when that's simply not true. And we only found out because the mayor, Mayor Black, and I and the community, we insisted that we have a public Q&A with ProEnergy. And I think it should disqualify them to claim that they have partnership with the Indigenous nations when they don't. There are also mistakes in their environmental impact assessment submission, which I also feel like should disqualify them or at least ensure we have a more thorough process.
We should mention an option for Indigenous ownership that is on the table, but they have just not decided whether to exercise that option yet. There are, though, some Mi'kmaq nations in New Brunswick who do appear to be supportive of the project. The Papineau First Nation Chief Terry Richardson sits on the board of the North Shore Mi'kmaq Tribal Council. Here's some of what he told our producer.
First Nations, we push renewables. Obviously, that is our goal. I mean, is to reduce the carbon footprint of Canada and specifically New Brunswick. And we're doing fairly good. I mean, we think that 80% of our carbon emissions have been addressed in the province of New Brunswick. That's pretty good. Ideally, we would like to see 100%. But if we're doing more and above and punching our weight, I think that shows, you know, that we're doing really well as a province. And we have an energy situation in the province within a few years that if we're not forward thinking of the next, you know, 10 to 15 years of addressing the energy problems in the province, we're going to end up in a very serious situation.
Chief Richardson also says he agrees that this project is necessary to bring more renewables online down the line, and he wants to see First Nations benefit from it. So what would you say to Chief Richardson?
What I would say is, you know, Indigenous nations absolutely should benefit from energy projects, but I don't think this is a good energy project. What we really need to do is have that longer-term vision that he's referencing and thinking about in 25 years where we want to be. Do we really want to be burning fracked gas and diesel? That's not what we want. What we want is to take the climate crisis seriously, take the affordability crisis seriously, and invest in energy efficiency for New Brunswickers to lower their power bills, and to invest in renewable energy, which is where we need to be going.
Before we let you go, I do want to give our listeners, Megan, a sense of the place we're talking about, the place you call home, the place you grew up. You know, Tantramar is the new, name after Amalgamation. And to let our listeners know, that's from Acadian French. That word, refers to the din or the noise made by some of the marsh birds. But what do you want people to know about your home?
This is a really special place. It's very beautiful. The Tantramar marshes are an amazing spot that are quite vulnerable. Often when we talk about the Shenecto Isthmus, we talk about the risk of flooding. This is a place that we really want to protect. This is part of a flyway where migratory birds travel, and people who are living in this rural area right on the marshes farming, we're really connected to the land. We actually have like the mallard duck on our pins and painted on our crosswalks. Nature's really part of who we are. It's just such a special place in terms of being, a smaller town, but there's a university, Mount Allison University here, which brings lots of interesting people and lots of interesting things. It's a really awesome place in terms of arts and culture and music. And so I encourage people to come visit. It's a really special place.
Megan Mitten, I'm so pleased we could speak. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Megan Mitten is the Green Party MLA for Tantramar. We reached her in Sackville, New Brunswick. We also reached out to New Brunswick Premier Susan Holt about the proposed Centre Village gas plant. We did not hear back by airtime. As you heard, the story of the proposed gas plant in Tantramar is precisely the kind of news the now-defunct Sackville Tribune Post would have covered. That paper dated back to 1870. Its last ever edition went to print in 2020, before the pandemic and ultimately its corporate owners shut it down for good. In its absence, various outlets have done what they can to fill the void. A campus radio station, CHMA, maintains a community newsroom at Mount Allison University. The nonprofit New Brunswick Media Co-op covers overlooked stories from across the province. And in one especially Sackville-oriented corner of the internet, you'll find a website with the tagline, "The New York Times does not have a bureau in Sackville, New Brunswick, but the New York Times does." That's Wark as in Bruce Wark, a citizen journalist who once worked for the CBC and is spending his retirement covering, among other things, the proposed Tantramar gas plant. We reached Bruce Wark in Sackville.
Bruce, come clean. Are you really retired in any meaningful sense of the word?
Well, I wish I were retired, but I'm actually working a pretty full week these days trying to cover the local town council here and other events in this municipality. I mean, it's really been quite hectic.
You could retire. It's in your hands, but you moved to Sackville in 2015 and then decided pretty quickly that you would start covering the news there in a volunteer capacity. Why were you compelled to do that?
Well, I felt I needed a hobby, something to do, and I thought, well, I'll just go down to town council and cover the meetings and do he said, she said reporting about, whose sidewalks getting fixed, what potholes are getting patched sort of thing. And I got down there and discovered that it was much more. I hadn't covered municipal politics since I covered Brampton Town Council for a small Ontario radio station in 1969. So I had forgotten how complex a municipal politics can be. And besides that, the local paper here was trying to cover town council, but they had a handicap. Town council meetings were on Monday nights, and the paper went to press on Tuesday. So that meant that they often couldn't include stories from the town council. So I was filling in the gaps, and I kind of got addicted to it. Yeah. And the more I did, the more I felt like doing,
It can be really difficult work. Anyone who covers councils can tell you that, but crucial at the same time, because by being there, you soak up everything. And once you make those contacts, that's where the stories are. You mentioned what the Sackville Tribune Post was up against. Then it's gone. If you didn't do this, what would that mean?
Well, it would mean no real professional journalism coverage of the town council. There's people on Facebook, of course, who comment on things, but generally, unless there's a really contentious issue, nobody shows up at town council. I'm often the only person there. So people depend on you to kind of tell them what happened there.
But as you well know, it's a very small place where you live and contentious issues, as you said. So what kind of impact does the work you do have on your relationships in town? Some people might appreciate you giving them the information. Others may not, I can imagine.
Yeah, that's true. Sometimes I think, you know, in my darker moments, I think, you know, they don't want me covering town council, because what happens is you put your links up, and then on Facebook especially, people weigh in, and the comments can be quite harsh. And I think that councillors all over Canada are facing this now, getting really hostile responses on social media. And if you have a thin skin, you know, it's pretty hard to bear. And so there are times, I think, when they wish that nobody was there to cover the meeting so that people wouldn't know about the things that they're commenting on.
Well, Bruce, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Bruce Wark runs the news website, The New York Times, out of Sackville, New Brunswick. That's where we reached him. So the people of Tantramar, Sackville in particular, are committed to citizen journalism, and they're committed to a surprising number of other projects as well. Before amalgamation in 2023, the town was home to just about 6,000 people. And yet, despite its diminutive stature, Sackville boasts a vibrant art scene. It's got two thriving galleries, an independent bookstore that just celebrated 30 years in business, a celebrated cultural festival known as Sappy Fest, a proud Acadian history. And as we speak, one of Canada's best-known literary publishers is in the midst of moving from its already small home of Kentville, Nova Scotia, to the even smaller backyard of Sackville's own Keegan Hawthorne. We reached Mr. Hawthorne, the new owner of Gaspereau Press in Sackville.
Keegan, moving is not fun at the best of times. So if we were to walk around your property, what would we see these days?
Yeah, well, right now I'm talking to you from a renovated garage that is, the outside is unfinished, so you'd see a lot of Tyvek and tuck tape. and inside, I have moved some, I've begun the process of moving some of the equipment that will eventually be the new Gaspereau Press. So some of this has been in storage for a while, some of it has been in my living room for the past 5 years. And this is a bit of an interim space. We'll be working out of another larger kind of warehouse for the winter.
Okay, so there's some organizing and reorganizing.
A lot of organizing and reorganizing to come, yes.
How do you keep it together and stay calm?
You just have to put one foot in front of the other. That's really the only way to get through a big transition like this. So,
good advice.
Fortunately, there are enough details to keep you from getting overwhelmed.
Okay, well, that's good. The press, as you know, is small but beloved, in no small part because so much is done by hand. Give our listeners a sense of how unique the Gaspereau process is.
Yeah, well, people often talk about economies of scale in the context of publishing, and usually that's taken to mean that bigger is always better, i.e. cheaper. But that does cut both ways. And so there are economies of scale that come into play when you deliberately stay small, when you deliberately choose to work in a small community, like a family farm that sells their produce at the farmer's market. If you're not tilling millions of acres of carrots, you don't need that million-dollar harvester. So Gaspereau Press has always chosen to be a small operation, and that has allowed us to make books in the way that feels best for us. And that is, being involved in the process by hand. So currently the books are printed and bound in-house. And we add letterpress printed jackets. So these are hand printed jackets that are wrapped around. And so all of our books are handmade in that sense.
What does it offer? You know, what is the value in that handmade process?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the analogy would be to sort of like shaker furniture. You know, your bum feels better when you sit on a well-made seat. A good chef will tell you that you eat with your eyes as well as your tongue. Well, I would say that you read with your fingers and your ears and your nose, if it's in the book deep enough. So
it's an experience.
It's an experience, yeah. And paying attention to the details of something's construction will have a tangible effect on the way that the reader experiences the work.
You will likely remember, and some of our listeners might as well, when the novel The Sentimentalists won the Giller Prize back in 2010. Mm-hmm. It was a Gaspro Press book, and it's an understatement to say the press was very hard-pressed to keep up with demand, and there was a lot of debate about, you know, why do it this way when so many people want to get their hands on this book. What has kept them and now you so committed to doing it that way?
There are a lot of presses in this country that do it differently, you know, I am grateful for them. Gaspro Press is committed to producing books this way because it's the way we enjoy producing books. And it's valued, and, you know, the press has continued to attract great writers and continues to, you know, win, our books continue to win awards. So the process is valued by both readers and by writers.
When this move was announced last year, Gaspro's co-founder Andrew Steeves spoke with our CBC colleagues in Nova Scotia about another thing that's very important to him and the press overall, that it stay in a small community. Here's a bit of what he said then.
People need to be able to see that these things are possible. They don't just happen in faraway, important places. But also I think our culture is stronger as it is diversified, as it is spread out. I think that some of the characteristics of what we've been able to do have been influenced by the fact that we're not sitting in an office tower in Vancouver or Toronto or Montreal.
Do you share that sentiment and that conviction?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, constraints can be generative. And one of the reasons that I was excited to take over Gaspro Press and continue operating it in this way is that the constraints that are inherent in living in a small town are really exciting for me.
You know, our listeners heard some of the other creative endeavors that are flourishing in Sackville. What is it about? It's that constraint, as you mentioned, perhaps for you and some others, but what else accounts for the fact that creativity is flourishing there, do you think?
It's a good question. There's certainly an economic aspect to it. You know, we live at the moment in a generally economically depressed region, and yet we have a very good, very large employer in this town, in the university, which certainly plays a part in fostering the arts. The other part of that is that because the cost of living is relatively affordable, people can afford to try things here, you know. It is easier to take a risk as an artist if you're not living in a condo in Toronto or Vancouver and having literally sky-high rents.
Keegan, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you for this.
Thank you very much.
Keegan Hawthorne is in the midst of moving Gaspro Press from Kentville, Nova Scotia, to his family's property in Sackville, New Brunswick. And that's where we reached him. If you just tuned in and thought that seemed like a lot of stories about small town New Brunswick, you are a typically discerning listener. All week this week, we are bringing you a special series focusing on smaller towns and cities across Canada. Tomorrow, on the Tuesday edition of As It Happens, we'll go to Vulcan, Alberta.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.